Yosemite Valley will close at noon today. Park officials are concerned about the growing and very smoky Ferguson fire. On Insight, the story from CAL FIRE and CAP Radio reporters Bob Moffett and Ezra Romero. Then McClatchy's regional editor Lauren Gustas talks with me about the changing newsroom at the Sacramento Bee and the future of what is sometimes called the paper paper. A writer in Forbes magazine this week suggested that local libraries be replaced by Amazon bookstores. And that set off a lot of reaction. We'll hear from the director of the Sacramento Public Library, Rivka Sass. Later in the hour, the band Iola Rose with Tina Makua from the TV show Good Day Sacramento. The band is hosting a songwriting workshop this weekend, and you are invited. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. People are being moved out of Yosemite Valley and Wawona right now because of the nearby Ferguson fire. In about 3 hours, the national park will be closed to the public. We're going to get updates from CAP Radio reporters Bob Moffett and Ezra Romero. But first, the latest from CAL FIRE. On the phone is Deputy Communications Director Mike Moeller. And Chief Moeller, thanks for taking time again to be with us on Insight.
Beth, thank you so much for having us.
Will you explain what's happening with the Ferguson fire, which started on July 13th?
Well, right now, the fire start is at 38,522 acres, 25% containment. Unfortunately, the fire continues to grow just with what we're seeing with weather and fuel conditions. And we still have, you know, several communities that are threatened, including the park, which will be closed.
Mariposa County officials are concerned about the level of smoke and initiated this decision. What is CAL FIRE's role in the decision to close the park? And tell me about the smoke in this fire.
Well, we work CAL FIRE, the county, and also the National Park Services. We work very closely together with our federal partners. We make the recommendation on the threat level. We let the National Park Service review that threat level, and at that point, they make the ultimate decision with input, again, from CAL FIRE, Mariposa County, and the incident to make the decision to close the park. And it really is, one, air quality, but two, for public safety.
Is this a smokier fire than usual, or does this have to do more with wind direction and the valley?
Well, actually, all of those. I mean, it's producing smoke. Like, we've had several fires, unfortunately, out in this area. But with the type of weather that we're experiencing right now, where the smoke is really settling into the valleys, where we have no wind to actually lift it, we're seeing it staying, you know, throughout the morning into the afternoon before we actually get any type of clearance. But it really is, and again, the topography, you're looking at drainages, valleys where the smoke settles into it. It makes it very difficult for it to actually lift and come out of that area.
Tell me where the fire lines are right now in connection with the park itself and about that firefight on the front lines.
Well, it's within a few miles of the park. It's still moving towards it. We still have road closures off of State Route 140. But again, weather's playing a major factor. And as you well know, we are going into heat advisories for the next several days, which increases fire activity. So unfortunately, you combine the weather, the topography, and what we're seeing right now, it's just a very, very difficult firefight.
What tools can't you use? You have some biggies in the arsenal, including the air tanker. Air drops of retardant are common. Because of the terrain, is anything ruled out at this point?
Well, unfortunately, going back to when we talk about the smoke conditions, when we have smoke levels like that where it settles into these valleys, aircraft, unfortunately, are ineffective because we cannot get in there to use them. And that's not only our fixed-wing air tankers, but also our helicopters. That becomes a safety issue and also visibility. So what we've been seeing is the smoke will start to lift midday into the afternoons is where we can actually hit it hard with aircraft. But the smoke conditions are really, really hampering the use of air assets.
This is one of many fires in the state, obviously, Chief, and every fire is critical. But besides the Ferguson fire, what others are of most concern today?
Well, right now we have what's called the CAR fire. That's in Shasta County. It's over 4,500 acres. It's actually into timber. We're seeing extreme fire behavior. And for your listeners, when we say extreme fire behavior in timber, it means crowning. Really, the tops of the trees are just is a running fire, very dangerous fire. And again, that's in Whiskeytown National Park up in Shasta County. That's a priority right now. But we have 7 major fires throughout the state that are burning. And we move our resources depending on the threat level to life and property, which is our priority, is to protect life, protect property.
This is going to be, I think, the hottest day, at least here in the Valley, Chief, all week. And we don't have a dramatic change in the weather pattern. What does that mean for the fire battle?
It makes it difficult. And we're already planning ahead. We're staffing additional equipment, not only here in Northern California, but we're seeing a heat wave statewide. So we're going to staff additional resources statewide, ready to respond. But anytime we see weather like this, what's going to come out of this is you're going to see anything from a fire weather watch all the way to red flag warnings in several areas across the state. So it is concerning and makes the firefight difficult, but we'll be prepared.
All right, Chief. I'm always glad to have a bit of your time, all things considered. So thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you, Beth.
That is CAL FIRE Deputy Director of Communications Mike Moeller. By the way, we're going to post a link to the CAL FIRE webpage. There's so much information about all the individual fires across the state, and you can track the information that way. Now, though, let's change gears to CAP Radio reporter Bob Moffitt, who's joining us by phone. Hi, Bob. Why don't you tell me where you are and what's happening around you?
Well, I'm in Mariposa County, but I'm far enough away that I can see the entire smoke plume and the distance that the smoke has traveled from the Ferguson fire. And it's grown actually here in just the last half an hour or so to take up, probably about 100 degrees or so of visibility from my vantage point, which is pretty much right on the Mariposa Merced County line.
Did you make it into the park last night?
I did. Got there about dark and talked to some folks who were leaving, and even talked to one young man who, warning be damned, he was gonna camp there. And so it was. Talked to people there. Talked to people in Groveland. Talked to more people down the hill. I just kind of talked to people as I made my way up the hill, which is maybe why it took me so long to get there.
Well, let's hear from one of those people. This is Jason Franks, who talked with Bob last night.
It makes sense. The valley was super smoky. There were points where it was like hard to see. Like we went all the way close to half them, and we couldn't even really see it.
Bob, what smoky conditions, what kind of conditions did you experience in the park?
Well, at the very west side of the park, which is where the entrance is, there was no smoke whatsoever. It was a beautiful night, and the stars were out, and you'd never know that there was a fire. But once you head in, then the smoke starts to get thicker, and at a couple of spots, you can see the fire line on the ridge from the park. And then once you get into the valley floor itself, then it gets really thick. As Jason said, if you can barely see El Capitan, then there's obviously a visibility issue there.
So all visitors to the park were being told they would have to leave. The park would be closed today. Here's part of Bob's conversation with a woman named Lori Walker.
They told us that they were closing the park and they were kicking everybody out of the campground. And we said, "Is the friends of the air quality?" And they said, "Yeah, but as we're driving out, you can see the fire burning on the ridge." Yeah, hopefully it doesn't go clear into the valley.
Nobody is sounding terrified, and I've heard some of your reports this morning, but when you can see fire on the ridge, I think it's a terrifying visual.
It is. The ridge, though, is also is the fire line that was identified early by fire crews as the place to stop this fire, and so they really hit that hard at the beginning. The thing is that fire goes uphill much more easily than it goes downhill. So if you get there and you set the fire line before it gets there, and in some cases burn the fuels between the fire line and the fire, which is what they're in the middle of doing now, then you can see it. But as long as you can keep it from jumping, then you've got a pretty good shot. And I did want to mention one quick thing yesterday from talking to Incident Command. was that the bark beetle infestation has reared its ugly head again, in that some of the trees that are infested are falling. They're ripe for burning really hot and really fast, which doesn't help firefighters any. And then you've got the trees that are just falling and fire and falling across the containment lines, which is how apparently a couple of the breaches of containment lines have occurred.
You're listening to CAP Radio reporter Bob Moffett. The Ferguson fire is still outside of the boundary of the Yosemite National Park. It's burned a little over 38,500 acres since it started July 13th. We're going to hear from one more person that you talked to, Bob. Do you want to set this man up? His name is Adam.
Oh, Adam was from Poland, and he and the family had come into Yosemite to spend the day. They were headed out anyway, so they weren't really upset with the timing of the closure. But certainly, just like anybody else that went into the park yesterday, you know, the smoke made it very difficult to see.
Oh, actually, you know, this is a very beautiful national park, but of course the fire that we have somehow hindered our visit, you know.
Hmm. Well, it's true for a lot of visitors. Sometimes this is their one glimpse in their lifetime. But at this point, it's a safety situation. Yosemite Valley and Wawona will be closed today at noon. And Bob, what are you hearing about how long the closure might last?
At least until Sunday. And it's a good news, bad news situation, really, when you think about it, is that, yeah, it thinks that they've got to close it until Sunday, but they've set a date, and with the increasing amount of containment that fire crews have had, that's a pretty good sign that they're hoping to have contained a lot more of it by that time so that they will have a lot less smoke from actual, you know, forest fire, and it'll be more smoke from containment fires or backfiring as they try to burn the brush in between the fire lines and the encroaching fire.
And as we heard Chief Mueller say, they're at about 25-26% containment now. Okay, thanks so much for the report, Bob. Stay safe out there, and we'll listen for more later on in All Things
Sure.
Considered. That is CAP Radio reporter Bob Moffett. He was talking to us from Yosemite Valley. And you know that we're in the midst of airing a podcast series called Yosemite Land. It is by CAP Radio's environment reporter Ezra Romero. Ezra's reporting looks at the future of firefighting in the Yosemite Valley. He's joining us by phone right now. He's actually attending a conference in Philadelphia. I don't think this is a story you expected to be talking about this week, was it, Ezra?
None at all, actually. I knew the fire was happening, but I didn't expect it to rear its head this far.
So for your podcast, you talked with Yosemite's fire chief. What did she have to say about fire in the park?
Yeah, so Kelly Martin, she's the first female fire chief of Yosemite. And, you know, we spoke a couple weeks ago before this fire even happened, and she basically said that, you know, a big fire was expected and that one could happen because of all the dead fuel on the ground in the park and outside of the park with all the dead trees and with about 100 years of suppression efforts. We've all talked about that in the past. There's just a lot of fuel on the ground. So she said, especially with last year, with all the rain that happened, there's a lot of growth that happened on that lower elevations. And that's sort of where this fire started, right at the lower elevation. And so it just kind of makes sense that we're seeing it, according to what she said.
But what we're seeing on a year-to-year basis is really much hotter summers and much warmer nights. And so what that does is it really increases the stress on the trees and the vegetation. So, you know, correlate that to climate change or not, what we are seeing absolutely, definitively, is that we are seeing hotter summers. And with that, hotter, drier summers just come with another layer of more dead trees and the mortality. And those fires that burn in August are much more severe.
Yes, as we're forecast to have over 105 degrees in the Sacramento area today. So Ezra, as with any fire that moves into big lands and protected lands, there's a question about whether to let it burn or not. What did she say about that dilemma?
You know, she said that's something that she is facing every day, and she wants to create a plan with Yosemite National Park and agencies around the area, Forest Service and Cal Fire, to do more what they call prescribed burns, you know, in the off season when it's not fire season, burning parcels of land, maybe in small scale and large scales, to prevent these large scale wildfires, you know, because a huge swath of the forest in the Sierra Nevada need fire because it's a natural thing that happens and it helps regulate the forest. But with suppression, with a history and culture of suppressing fires, she said they're disservicing themselves, you know. So she would like to see more of these prescribed burns, but she said there should also, in some ways, these larger fires should be allowed to burn. But that brings up an issue because of visitors and people live in these areas, which is why we have, say, Cal Fire on these big fires, preserving life and homes.
Well, in your podcast, I know you're going to look ahead to Yosemite in the future, the kind of trees, the kind of forest that might be there. But for now, in the interest of time, Ezra, if you kind of wrap this up and point us to where we can hear more in the podcast.
In next week's episode of Yosemite Land, we are going to talk about fire. We were going to talk about rock climbing next week, so that'll be pushed off to another week. But we figured, with this big fire happening, this would be a key moment to hear more from Kelly Martin, to hear more from a UC Merced professor who's studying fire and climate change in the park, and to hear from reporters like Bob Moffitt and maybe someone else about what's currently happening. So we're going to go into a little bit of the history of fire and what scientists are thinking about the future of these places and how they're going to look.
Okay, Ezra, thanks for checking in with us, and we'll make sure to post a link to Yosemite Land, the podcast, at capradio.org/insight. Take care.
Thanks.
And again, Yosemite Valley and Wawona are closed at noon today, Wednesday, at least through Sunday. You can find a link to the latest from Cal Fire at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Layoffs in the newsroom at the Sacramento Bee over the past few years have people wondering whether the daily paper might disappear at some point or become a digital-only subscription. Some of the longtime journalists who lost their jobs or retired, particularly this spring, have shared those concerns with us. We've linked those conversations to our webpage. In January, the paper's parent company, McClatchy, appointed a regional editor to oversee the newsrooms at papers in Idaho, Washington, and California, including the Sacramento Bee. And that editor is Lauren Gustis. She's joining me in the studio to talk about the changes happening in this newsroom and some of the others. Hi, Lauren. Glad to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Beth.
The Yosemite Ferguson fire story is a great example for us to begin with. Compare how the Bee mobilized teams to cover other big fires and what's happening with the coverage of this fire this week.
Yeah. Prior to our current structure, we would have sent reporters from Sacramento, Modesto, Fresno, and Merced to cover the Ferguson fire. And in all likelihood, they would have written the same exact story. We weren't communicating. We weren't taking the opportunity to say, here are all of the many things that we could do to serve our readers and to serve our communities effectively. Let's spread those resources out in a way that makes sense. And instead, we would have gone and done the same thing for the printed paper the next day. And now, today, what we have is an organization that communicates every single day up and down the state. So at 8:30 a.m., editors from all of our California newsrooms hop on a call to talk about what the most important stories of the day are and then to allocate resources effectively. So we've got reporters from Fresno, we've got photographers from Merced, and we've got videographers from Sacramento, graphic artists from Sacramento supporting our coverage of the Ferguson fire. And we're able to offer a far more dynamic experience for readers across platforms than we would have previously.
That sounds more streamlined and efficient and most likely a better use of resources. And yet the concern with some of the staff that were laid off this spring in particular was about the depth and the experience of the reporting staff, mm-hmm. the loss of veteran journalists, the loss of people who had cultivated years of relationships, not only with the people they interview, but with the very loyal readers. Mm-hmm. I know journalism is a passion and a focus for you. So how do you speak to that worry?
Yeah, that's a significant concern, and it's a good question. So if we are to take the Ferguson fire specifically, we would continue the thread that we started with here. No one in our newsrooms knows Yosemite better than the reporters who have worked that story in Fresno. Fresno has determined that Yosemite is of critical importance to it. And so regardless of whether a reporter has been at the Bee for 2 years, the Fresno Bee, or 20, they understand that subject matter in an intimate capacity that enables them to deliver a sophisticated report. It does take time to develop that sophistication. We do miss the reporters that we lost. Since I have started my career as a journalist, which is over 15 years ago, we have seen nothing but shrinking newsrooms. I'm motivated to find a way forward. We are motivated at the Sacramento Bee and across our region to find a way forward so we no longer have to say goodbye to those folks who we did miss and do miss, earlier this year.
Speaking specifically to your own career path, there was a time when you were a sports editor in Reno, in fact, and one of the layoffs this year in Sacramento involved the only sports columnist mm-hmm. in this area. Mm-hmm. An area where we have an NBA team, a AAA baseball team, a pitch for an MLS team, and a very vibrant local and regional sports arena. So let's get away from Ferguson and talk specifically to that decision.
Yeah. Any decision that we would have made was going to be difficult. Any decision to say goodbye to any reporter is a difficult decision. What we try to look at is where are those places that we can make the biggest difference in our community? Where can we hold leaders accountable? Where can we do public service journalism that's going to improve the lives of people who live in our communities? And how can we allocate as many resources as possible to those stories and to those threads?
2 points to what you just said. I wasn't directing that question so specifically about the person, but that role of a sports columnist, for example. And we are talking journalistically, but the former employees who have talked with us here have spoken about the revenue decisions that are being made mm-hmm. and the fact that revenue for McClatchy is down 60% plus, and that we are in a time of changing technology, and then there was the Knight Ridder purchase about a decade ago. And so that the decisions aren't necessarily how do we cover the community best. It's really about how do we save the company financially.
Yeah, I feel that. And we can control what we can control, right? We know that every day when we walk in the door, we have an opportunity to make a difference. Every day when we walk in the door, we can tell a story that's going to change a life or that's going to engage more people, or that's going to make the Sacramento Bee the most relevant legacy news source in our community. Okay, so if we start there, we say, okay, what can we do today that's going to make a difference? What can we do today that people would be engaged in? If we can deliver on that promise, if you look at today's coverage, I think we delivered. I mean, shoot, the stories that I read this morning in the SACB from the DMV employee who slept 3 hours on the job for 3 years to how Sacramento City Council is looking at changing who can speak and who cannot speak during its public comment period. Those are relevant stories that impact how we live our best lives in Sacramento, right? So if we can start there and then we can develop a good habit with our readers, right, and they can come back to us. And then if we can ask them to support us, to support local journalism via a digital-only subscription, via a subscription to the Sacramento Bee, we can find a sustainable way forward. And that's what I'm focused on. I'm focused on how do we find a sustainable future for local journalism.
But it's undeniable that while there might be 12 or 16 pages of stories like you just described, there used to be 28 or 30 or 32 pages. And the scope of the ability to attend more public meetings, perhaps, and hold officials accountable, or get more in depth in some of those longer term projects where a story is fleshed out and followed over time. Those are the things that are changing. And were you just suggesting that you're trying to regrow the audience and move back up to some of what I just described seems to be disappearing?
We reach more people now than we ever have. We reach millions of people online every month and hundreds of thousands in the printed product. In total, more people than we ever have. We have a good foundation on which to build, and we can no longer be all things to everyone. We've got to make difficult decisions. What are those stories? Where are the places that we need to dig in or recommit to that are so critically important to our futures, our communities, to journalism? We have conversations about that every day in the newsroom. You look at the Stephon Clark shooting and where the Sacramento Bee was in that shooting. We had sports reporters on that story. We had education reporters on that story. That was the most important story in our community in the month in which occurred, and probably all of this year, right? So we stayed with that story after going into South Sacramento to talk about how police are policing in the neighborhood, how things are changing with respect to engagement between police and residents. We'll go back into that community multiple times throughout the summer, and we'll position ourselves to be prepared to visit in a meaningful way with the story ahead of the 6-month anniversary of the shooting, so we can talk about how we're doing and what needs to change.
You know, Ed Fletcher, who had been on that story, a longtime veteran of the Sacramento Bee newsroom and the union rep, one of the union reps at the paper, was with us after he was laid off, talking exactly about that story, Lauren, and saying he had been cultivating relationships and storylines, marching with some of the protesters. And when he lost his job, that work that he was doing suddenly ended. And some of the question here is that a reporter like Ed Fletcher might be replaced by a young technologist, if that's the correct term, somebody that's more digitally savvy, somebody at a different pay scale, and in his case, not involved with the union, because I believe the union contract was not renewed after the transition. How does that still equate to the quality and the integrity of journalism that McClatchy, and in particular the Sacramento Bee, were always expected to deliver?
You've spoken with Ed. We've spoken with Ed. Reporters in our newsroom have stayed in touch with Ed. They're friends with Ed. And Ed would want us to do right by this story. Ed would want you to do right by that story, right? And Ed remains supportive of local journalism. You see that on a daily basis if you follow him on social media. He wants us to succeed. He wants you to succeed. He wants all of journalism to be better and stronger. And we've got to focus on the talented group of reporters and editors and photographers that we have in our newsroom. The first thing that we attack with respect to how we do the work we do is, what is the story? How do we tell a quality story that's going to be relevant for our audience?
And that's question is it a different story if Ed tells it versus a young new reporter to the area who may have different tools, but aren't they different stories?
It all starts with the story, and that is a process that involves multiple people, editors, photographers, reporters. And if we don't get the story right, nothing else matters, right? So if we don't get the story right, it doesn't matter if we can social it effectively or if it has a wonderful video or a pithy headline. We have got to get the quality of the work right first. If we don't, then the rest of the process is irrelevant.
So less emphasis on who the journalist is, more emphasis on did that reporter get the story? Am I understanding that right?
As we conceptualize a story, it's really important that we put it through the paces before we go out and report on it.
And can I fact check that point about the union? I believe that the union reps were included in the layoffs, so the union contract has not been renewed at the Bee. Is that correct?
The union contract has not been renewed at the Bee. There's also been some, you know, and I'm not an expert here, so forgive me, turnover within the union in San Francisco. So we are waiting on them to contact us so that we can reinitiate that relationship.
What is the size of the editorial staff at the Bee right now? And how is morale? What's happening in the newsroom because of all the transition?
Sure. We have anywhere from 60 to 65 folks in the newsroom, and it depends on, you know, the day or the week, so to speak, as an organization of our size flexes in and out. And we've spent a good bit of time talking about how we feel about where we have been and where we're going. And I think that's the only way that we will be successful. If we bury our heads and don't talk about where we have been, we will hold on to that and it won't be constructive. So we've been doing some work in that space and we'll continue to do work in that space. If you were to ask me what the culture of the newsroom was, certainly you would understand that it's coming from a different place than a reporter. And I am hopeful. And I hope that you would hear from others that they are hopeful as well. We have a plan to build a sustainable future. If we can execute on that plan, then we will walk away from these difficult conversations that we have continued to have, that other news organizations across the country have continued to have for too long.
You're listening to Lauren Gustus. She is the regional editor for McClatchy, overseeing newsrooms at papers in Washington, Idaho, and California, including the Sacramento Bee. We are talking about a transition that the company is making to a more digital subscription model. Before we get to that, what do you see as the future of the paper? You must know how often the question is asked in Sacramento right now. What's going to happen to the Bee? Is the paper going to go away?
Let me dispel any rumors that may be out there with respect to the future of the printed product, and that we have no plans to make material changes to the days in which the paper is delivered or the frequency of the Bee as a 7-day printed product. There are hundreds of thousands of people who read the printed product every day. And again, it goes back to the quality of the story, right? The thing that we're focused on in our newsroom, most importantly, is what is today's story and how are we going to write that in a way that's going to engage with people most effectively across platforms? And then once we make that happen, how do we package it across platforms? So the quality of the story is consistent, right? Whether or not you're reading it on through Facebook or in the printed product, or you found it on Reddit, or you found the video on YouTube, it's all there. We've got to lock in on the quality of the story at the start.
I do want to talk about this goal for a number of digital subscriptions. Yeah. And people are talking about the cost right now, that it can be over $600 a year for the, if you're still getting the paper and the online subscription and additional publications. So it's become very expensive. What is that goal for online subscriptions and how close are you to it?
The goal is 60,000 digital-only subscribers to the Sacramento Bee. I've done the math. If we can get to 60,000 digital-only subscribers, we will fully fund newsroom costs, so salary, benefits, travel, you name it, with that 60,000 digital-only subscribers number at a digital-only subscription of about $160 a year. Right now, we have 15,000 digital-only subscriptions, so big gap, right? And we have a plan that includes, you know, benchmarks to check in against at certain intervals. And I believe it's achievable. It's not achievable this year. It's not achievable next year. But I am confident that we can get there. I'm confident that by this time next year, we can double where we're at now. And then it'll obviously take us a little bit longer to get to that 60,000.
You can appreciate that this is a busy news day and that I had hoped that maybe we'd have a much longer conversation. So what I'd like to do is invite this to be a continuing dialogue, Lauren, because I think it's important to the whole region as well as the state overall in terms of McClatchy newspapers and the print industry to know what's happening to the paper of record and the place where McClatchy's publishing began. So could I get a yes to another conversation soon about this?
I'd love to talk more.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today. That is Lauren Gustis. She is the regional editor for McClatchy, overseeing the newsroom at the Sacramento Bee. We're going to post links to our previous conversations on this topic. And as you heard us say, it's an ongoing dialogue. You can find that at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Forbes magazine posted an opinion piece over the weekend with the headline, Amazon should replace local libraries to save taxpayers money. You can imagine the backlash from libraries and library users across the country, including here in Sacramento. In the studio with me is the director of the Sacramento Public Library, Rivka Sass. Hi, Rivka.
Hi, Beth.
So what was your reaction when you saw that?
Well, I started to read it and it seemed a little disjointed to me, so I had to put it down and pick it up and read it later because I was actually I was disbelieving, let's put it that way. I couldn't imagine the lack of foresight that went into writing those words.
Between then and now, you've also been out in the public giving a speech, attending the fair. Tell me more about the response.
Well, it was actually the perfect time to have the opportunity to speak before the Carmichael Chamber of Commerce. About 100 people showed up, and they were as amused and bemused as I was by the article. And what was so validating is that I finished my talk and people came up and said, while you were talking, I downloaded this app or I downloaded the magazine database that you talked about. And everything you said about children and early literacy was so vital. Take that. Amazon can't do that. And pretty much at the fair last night, it was the same reaction with amazing comments on the flip charts we put up about what can we do better? What do you like about the library? So it's been really validating.
In fact, there was so much reaction that Forbes has taken the article down. But some of the point that was being made is that maybe libraries are old-fashioned. And as we were just addressing in this conversation about newspaper and the print media, that there might be necessary changes in the future in certain ways. Not that that means libraries go away, but what might be necessitated? What is shifting?
I think there's this incredible sort of intellectual synergy around local television news, around libraries, around newspapers. I think we've all been having this conversation for more than 20 years. It's perfect, and this is the perfect time to talk about what do we need to be to meet the needs of our community. But the reality is that civic space and that opportunity to interact, whether it's with a newspaper, Cap Radio, look at all the things you're doing with your podcasts and how you're out there. We're all incorporating different types of media to make ourselves more relevant, but also reaching out. All 28 libraries were ballot drop-off sites. We're now 100% vote by mail in California. Sacramento County was one of five that embraced it and piloted it fast, and the library was right there at the front of it. That's the sort of attitude we have to have.
It was also pointed out by critics of this opinion piece that communities that would be hardest hit by libraries closing would be underprivileged communities where the resource is necessary. Does that hold true in this region?
I think libraries, the beautiful thing about libraries is we serve everyone and we serve people of all income levels. You can't get into the fair if you don't have the money to pay the entrance fee. It's absolutely true. This is a very, I call it Marie Antoinette syndrome sort of piece, right? Let them eat cake without understanding the implications of what the impact is if there were no libraries. And that's fine. I think the reaction told the rest of the story, and the fact that Forbes essentially apologized.
Because the library system does offer services that Amazon doesn't, and to put the comparison out there, as you say, raised a great debate. Do you want to extend an invitation, since we're talking in this way, about what your local library does and the reason to make a summer field trip to one?
Oh, I'd love to. And that includes serving meals to kids in 13 locations. That includes the 40 programs we do each week to help families with very young children get them ready to read. It includes the homework zones that we provide after school. It includes things like our Let's Talk About series, where we bring the community together to talk about very difficult and sometimes challenging issues in a civil and civic manner. That's really what we are. And I urge anybody who hasn't visited a library in a while to come in, and we'll show you around and you'll see what we're doing, and you will probably be surprised, just as I hope this gentleman is, if he's visited his local library now.
This was not a conversation we planned to have at this point in the summer, but I'm very glad we did. Thanks, Rivka.
Thank you.
Rivka Sass is the director of the Sacramento Public Library. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak, calling all musicians and lyricists now. The Iola Rose Band of Sacramento is hosting a songwriting workshop this Saturday at the Strum Shop. It's a good reason to talk with the band and hear some of their music. Hi, everybody.
Hi. Hi.
All right, Susan, you're up first. Susan Johnson, because this band is named in memory of your
my
mom.
Mother, yes, Iola Rose. It's the Iola Rose Band, and my mother introduced me to music when I was 2 years old, and we lost her to Alzheimer's in 2003. And so this is just a way of just remembering her, and I know she would have really enjoyed the music that we play. So
I think we should get right to some music so that everybody hears it. And I'll mention again that the Dinner Table Songwriting Workshop is, Bonnie, do you want to give the details?
Oh, this Saturday, it's called the Strum Shop in Roseville. What time is it? Did we start?
It's 4:30 to 5:30. It'll be an hour long.
Okay, and then there's a concert after that.
Okay, that was Carla Fontanilla. And look who made it to the studio. Tina McCoo is
Hi,
here.
Hi, Beth.
You jumped off the Good Day Sacramento set.
They let me out.
Come on over.
Yes.
And we hear your vocals in the band, right?
A little bit, little bit. These are the talented musicians and singers here. I just kind of hang out.
And Carla, you play?
I play ukulele and guitar.
Yeah. Bonnie?
I play guitar and vocal.
And you've been together for how many years? Four decades? 40?
Susan and I,
about 40 years almost.
Okay. And Susan, you sing?
And bass and violin, harmonica and guitar, 12 string, yeah.
All right. Let's get to some music, everybody.
All right.
This is the Iola Rose Band of Sacramento. And again, that songwriting workshop is this Saturday. We'll post a link. And the goal at the workshop is to create a song that is going to be performed in concert along with many of the band's originals. So we're happy to have them here in the studio. There are more performances. You can find those details on the website.
All right. So this song is going to be
This one is written by Bonnie. I wasn't raised in Hawaii. Born there, but not raised there. Here we go.
Well, I wasn't raised in Hawaii, but Hawaii raised me. Oh, I don't live in Now stay on mainland, my mommy and two aunties. They love to reminisce how they miss good fun on Waikiki. As sweet Leilani stars fly to lovely hula hands, when they dance and sing, to me that bring a splendor of the islands, but I wasn't raised in Hawaii. But Hawaii raised me. No, I don't live in Hawaii. But Hawaii lives in me. Meli kaliki maka haole, maka hiki ho. To me at Christmas time, no matter where I go, a cone sushi porn, lao lao, malasada, so oh no. And if you find that you don't like the kind, mashpika and mahalo, but I wasn't raised in Hawaii, but Hawaii raised.
The Iola Rose Band. Hold it right there. I'm going to have you play us out for the end of the show. Susan Johnson, Bonnie Brown, Carla Fontanilla, and Tina Makua. They have a songwriting workshop and concert at the Strum Shop in Roseville at 4:30 on Saturday. Then, yes, a concert at the Blue Goose Event Center in Loomis.
Yes.
Yeah, that's coming up on August 4th at 4 o'clock. Your voices blend in such a lovely way. It seems like you're sisters. If I close my eyes, I feel like you're all the same family. So I know you have one more song. I'm going to just say that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. We're back with another live show tomorrow. But what a treat. Tina, thanks for reaching out.
Thank
Always
you,
great to
Beth.
Have
Thank
you,
you
here.
So much.
And lovely. I think we need more of the spirit of the island. So thanks, ladies. Here they are again, the Iola Rose Band.
All alone on this crowded city street, well, that streetcar of desire is chasing after me. I've lost my way and I've lost my feet, oh. So what's a girl to do? What's a girl to?
What's a girl to do? What's a girl to do?
What's a girl to do?
What's a girl to do? What's a girl to do?
Slowly walking through this damp and dreary day, river's rising and you won't come out to play. Last time I held you, I could feel the truth that, well, you don't belong to me no more. What's a girl to?
What's a girl to do?
What's a girl to do? What's a girl to do?
What's a girl to do?
What do we do?
What's
Come
a girl
on, Carla.
To do?
Thank you.
I'll hitch a ride out to that Jenna coast and let that sea wash over me. Because for sure it's gonna take some time until it won't matter if you're mine. What's a girl to do? What's a girl to do? Because for sure it's gonna take some time till it don't matter if you're mine. Ooh, it don't matter if you're mine. It don't matter if you are mine.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.